All right. Well, for this portion of our two-part special on Venezuela, both its sort of current and historical context that have led to what is right now a international campaign of imperialist aggression against the state of Venezuela, I'll be speaking with Christina Schiavone. Christina is an academic and activist who works sort of in agrarian and environmental studies, more specifically with food movements and food sovereignty, among other topics. I am really excited to go over an essay that she actually wrote that I'll make sure to link in the bio, because it's very, very useful, written very clearly and effectively, and sort of dispels a lot of myths and rumors around food and agriculture in Venezuela. It's called The Politics of Food in Venezuela. But before we continue, I'm going to let Christina actually introduce herself, and she can probably do a better job of introducing herself. Christina?
Thanks, Devin. No, I think you did a great job. Thank you. But I can introduce myself in the context of my connection to Venezuela, I guess. I am a U.S.-based food activist, and I was working for an NGO in New York City when in 2006 I went to the World Social Forum as part of my work, and it happened to be in Caracas, Venezuela that year. And it really struck me going to Venezuela to find out that food sovereignty, something that many movements around the world have been pushing towards as kind of a political vision, was already in law in Venezuela, and that there were, in fact, a series of public policies and community organizing efforts and social movement efforts very much focused on trying to implement what in many other places was this broad-based vision. And coming from the US, where we were simply fighting against cuts to food stamps and other basic programs, trying to prevent family farmers from going into foreclosure, really fighting for basic things, to go and see communities actively organizing progressively together with their government instead of just putting out fires was really inspiring. And you could feel the energy and the momentum, which was very palpable. At the time, these efforts were still relatively new, but I kind of asked myself why I hadn't heard about them, especially since I was working on agri-food issues. So I came back to the US and I started asking about Venezuela and found out and started paying attention to the fact that there were so many misperceptions, and that even people in progressive movements on the left had a lot of misperceptions or weren't necessarily comfortable with Venezuela. So I started trying to find out more information, getting involved in Venezuela's solidarity efforts, and trying to help form more linkages between people working on food sovereignty and food justice issues in the US and in Venezuela. And that's what eventually led me to make this the focus of my graduate research, actually. So in 2012, I started a graduate school endeavor, which I'm just finishing up now. And that brought me back to Venezuela for research in 2013, 2015, and then actually living there for most of 2016 to 2018. So that's kind of me and my connection to the country.
And I appreciate you telling about sort of where you fit in to Venezuela. Putting yourself and your story sort of into the narrative of your work is important for us here at the Grounding Podcast, because that is sort of what we tried to model this podcast at the Walter Rodney Foundation after, right? This sort of active intellectual dialogue that happens. Mm-hmm. And I also find it striking hearing what you just said, because food and agriculture are central to any society. But in Venezuela, for the past few years, really, the politics of food have been displayed on like an international level, both with sort of marginal groups on the left praising their attempts at food sovereignty, and on the flip side, and probably the more larger side, is this Western narrative about food and food shortages and desperation and anger and upset, et cetera, all surrounding sort of food and agriculture. Can you sort of give the historical context to why food politics in Venezuela are important now, but in order to understand the full picture, you have to go much further back and understand the real history of it?
Absolutely, sure. And there's a lot to say on this, but I'll try to be succinct and can elaborate later. But basically, when we see the news today on Venezuela, we hear about a very polarized society. We hear about increasing levels of hunger and of poverty. We hear about a dependency on oil. All of these things are so important to be contextualized in terms of the history of the past several centuries, not even just decades, but centuries in Venezuela, starting with colonization by the Spanish in the 1500s. That may seem pretty far back to go, but the fact is that from the days of colonization, food was one of the first tools to create distinctions in society, where the food brought over from Europe, and especially wheat, was treated as something associated with civilization and progress and superiority. And the food of the indigenous and later Afro-indigenous population was treated as something lesser. When Venezuelan author talks about it being monstrified, the food, monstrification of the food that people were eating. So these divisions started very early on. So too was food a tool of resistance early on, where a leader of an indigenous uprising specifically encouraged his people to reject the food of the Spanish, particularly their wheat. So food has been political from early on. And also the agricultural system, where Venezuela's rich agricultural land was tapped into to create large plantations that ultimately depended on slavery and later low-wage labor of cacao and later coffee that were supplied to Europe as well as Mexico. This really became the centerpiece of the Venezuelan economy. So today, when people talk about a major focus on petroleum, this sort of mono-exporting model is nothing new. It dates back first to cacao, then to coffee as part of the colonial slave plantation economy. So that's really important context. And then going into the period of modernization, when petroleum began to be exploited in Venezuela in the 1920s, this led to a huge shift in the agri-food system in Venezuela, where it was cheaper to begin to import food. So the plantation economy was done away with, but there was already a lot of power and a number of rich families who were controlling the trading system. So they shifted from an exportation complex to an importation complex. And it was the same wealthy families now controlling the importation of food and the same wealthy families that the petroleum concessions were going to. So we already had a very divided society, very clear distinctions between rich and poor, very much also along the lines of race as well as class. So this goes way back. And then into the modernization period, there was an effort to renew the agricultural sector. But by now, the vast majority of the population was already living in the cities. Already by the 1930s, 40s, 50s, there were very high rates of urbanization in Venezuela. And Venezuela was already a net food importer. So there was this push to have high-tech machinery, quote-unquote, improved seeds and agrochemicals, but they also needed labor. And instead of encouraging the indigenous population to go back into farming, there was an effort actually to bring over Europeans. They called it very aptly the agricultural colonization process. And this was part of a whole idea that was sweeping across Latin America at the time of whitening, to try to whiten the society, to make it more pure, more productive. There was all sorts of ideology of this sort being thrown around at this time. So through the modernization period, there were several things happening. One, with the growing petroleum industry, there emerged a growing middle class, a largely white European a class of European ethnicity. And there was this new middle class of medium and large scale farmers that were largely brought in from Europe. Over this period, about 1 million people immigrated into Venezuela, and the vast majority were European. So, and at this time also, supermarkets were introduced into Venezuela. And supermarkets really helped to crystallize some of these divisions, where they were very much catering to the middle and upper classes with imported processed food, while the poor majority had very little access to much of this. Now, over time, that shifted, and supermarkets did make it into some of the poorer areas. And over time, much of the population came to rely on heavily processed food. But these distinctions, especially along lines of race and class around food, have run very deep in Venezuela for not even decades, but centuries.
So leading up from this period of what is known across Latin America as blanqueamiento, sort of whitening, not only in a literal sense, but in a labor sense, in a geographical sense, right, of moving Europeans into the country. From there, you're essentially saying these roots dive deep, and they sort of meet ahead with the Bolivarian Revolution, in the sense that these are what the revolution had to and largely still has to overcome, correct?
Absolutely. And it's worth talking about, and perhaps others have mentioned this too, but a really pivotal moment in the history leading up to the Bolivarian Revolution. So following the period of modernization, where there was a lot of investment going into agriculture, but you could question the type of agriculture and all the policies around it. But following that period into the late 70s, certainly into the 80s and 90s, the main push was on neoliberal policies, privatization throughout the food system, giving much more power to both national and multinational corporations to control the food system. Disparities only increased. By the late 1990s, more than half of the population was living in poverty, and more than a quarter was living in extreme poverty. So, and hunger was quite prevalent. And at this time, the already limited access that the poor working class had to food got even more limited when the president of the time signed a deal with the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, and almost overnight, prices of both transportation and food shot way up. Well, people living in Caracas, the poor working class communities called barrios, or the popular zones they're also called, people flooded down into the center of the capital in protest. And there was also raiding of food, but it was a very political act. And this was known as the Caracazo, kind of like the big blow of Caracas. This was in 1989. And what did the government of the time do? The president ordered the military to open fire on civilians, and thousands of lives were lost. In the official records, it's only hundreds, but it's estimated to be in the thousands. So no one has forgotten the Caracazo. It's still very fresh in the public consciousness. And that period from 1989 onward helped to directly usher in the Bolivarian Revolution, the rise of Hugo Chavez, his election in 1998, and his inauguration in 1999. And that's why food issues have been so central to the Bolivarian Revolution, for two main reasons. One is that the vast majority of the population was hungry or at the risk of hunger and food insecurity, number one. So there were immediate needs to tend to. And number two, as I tried to explain earlier, the food system had been part of what had been fostering these deep inequalities and divides in society. So there was kind of the dual charge of trying to help people be fed in the here and now, and at the same time working towards deeper transformation of the food system. So that was a key focus of the Bolivarian Revolution from the start, reflected in an article in the Constitution, Article 305, that guarantees the right to food to the whole population, and that that food should come from a sustainable domestic food system. Having that enshrined in the Constitution, which was developed by the people themselves, was a really important tool for a whole variety of efforts that have been underway in the Bolivarian Revolution. One other thing I'd like to just mention quickly is that the efforts towards food system change have not just been applauded by some groups on the left, but they have been consistently recognized by the UN Food and Agriculture Organization, which as recently even as 2015, had recognized Venezuela for having nearly eradicated hunger in advance of 2015. That was one of the Millennium Development Goals, to have hunger and poverty. And it's been recognized that Venezuela had achieved that goal in advance through the efforts of the Bolivarian Revolution. So when the mainstream media talks about the failures of socialism, the failures of the Bolivarian Revolution, et cetera, this really needs to be pointed out that there were some major achievements, which therefore raise questions as what in fact is happening today.
Definitely. And I think when I said marginal groups on the left, I meant more so in a political sense, the Western left. I guess I should have been more specific with that.
Sure.
The UN regional bodies, for example, the SDAC, which is the South African Development Community, which mm-hmm. is a regional bloc on the continent of Africa, 15 different countries, they've been strong supporters of the food sovereignty projects in Venezuela, as had the African mm-hmm. Union. So definitely that's a brilliant and great point. One of the things you mentioned in the essay that I think is key to this is you essentially position the Bolivarian Revolution, or at least the ignition of it, as a continuation of the Caracaso, right? So it's sort of a continuation mm-hmm. of these ongoing uprisings sparked by a number of different things. But I think that seeing it in that light as a continuation, or maybe even one of the highest forms of the Caracaso, really puts into perspective how central this food issue is and why it is still important today.
Absolutely. And I would just like to add that that sentiment has come mm-hmm. directly from people, so many people, countless grassroots activists that I've spoken with in Venezuela. And I also want to add that my two co-authors of the piece, Ana Felicien and Lixia Romero, both of them are Venezuelan activists and scholars. And so it was really amazing to get to work on this with them, where they're living and breathing all of this. But yes, that sentiment that the struggles of today are direct continuations of the past is something that you hear again and again, and really does seem to be embedded in the collective consciousness of the Bolivarian Revolution.
One thing I find fascinating, in Cuba, I see sort of the same sentiment, right? That mm-hmm. many, especially coming out of the what's known as the special period, right? The sort of lowest moment in the Cuban economy in many ways mm-hmm. In the 90s. But what we see is these great strides and revolutionary moments are seen as continuations of the original precursors which created them. They're not seen as sort of distinct historical moments, but they're revolutionary continuations. And mm-hmm. I just think that's such an important conception of history. I mean, that's just so important.
Absolutely. To understand both the resistance efforts and the issues. Almost, you know, any issue we can see today happening in Venezuela, and we can, of course, talk about how accurately it's all being presented, but even just taking much of it at face value, to at least acknowledge that this did not come out of nowhere, and it certainly did not come out of just the past few decades. Far from it.
Now, I want to get into what you describe as the Maíz Harina Arepa complex and why this specificity is sort of important to understanding food in Venezuela. And I know that sounds super general and broad to the listeners who might not have yet read this essay, but I think that once you explain it, it'll make more sense.
Sure. Yes. Well, it's that corn in many ways and how it's been consumed, used, transformed over time is in many ways emblematic of broader food politics in Venezuela, and in fact is very much key to broader food politics in Venezuela. Earlier on in the colonial period, corn was definitely considered inferior to wheat. And in fact, through the period of modernization, wheat came to take on a much greater part of the Venezuelan diet through trade relations with the U.S. And that's a whole other conversation, but this was part of a much broader push by the U.S. to deal with its overproduction of wheat and other commodities in the form of so-called food aid. And we can also get to the topic of food aid. But anyway, so imported wheat came to play a huge role in the Venezuelan diet, but this did change somewhat, or corn had a bit of a comeback by the 1960s through the modernization process in the form of this pre-cooked corn flour, it's called. And it's interesting because pre-cooked corn flour, it's very processed and refined, very white. In a way, it's as close to wheat, white wheat, as corn can come. And this pre-cooked corn flour forms the basis of the arepa, which traditionally and still into the present has been a very important part of the Venezuelan diet. This is sort of the daily bread of Venezuelans in the form of a corn patty. So pre-cooked corn flour was introduced in the 1960s, and with it, a huge marketing campaign where the marketing campaign was mainly targeted to women, and women significantly across different socioeconomic strata. And over time, this pre-cooked corn flour came to be the top consumed staple food of Venezuelans, which remains the case into the present, at the same time that wheat still continued to form a significant part of the diet as well. And something really important to mention is that there's a single company. It's named Empresas Polar, or just Polar, often it's called. A single company that controls at least 50 to 60% at least of the corn flour in Venezuela, in addition to controlling other key products in the Venezuelan food basket, different types of carbohydrates and oils that are used. So it's really important to flag this. And food sovereignty activists also have their critiques over the fact that even over the course of the Bolivarian Revolution, with all the efforts towards food sovereignty, the power of this company and a few other private companies that arose out of the days of colonization and modernization periods still managed to retain so much power over the food system. So many feel that it's no coincidence that when the shortages started to happen in 2013, the key missing product was pre-cooked corn flour. And this is almost never, this link is almost never, never, never mentioned in the mainstream narratives, because it doesn't go with the story that the shortages are simply the outcome of the failures of socialism, the failures of the Bolivarian Revolution. Well, maybe it could be argued that they're in part part of the failures of the Bolivarian Revolution to go far enough in its food system transformation. And of course, there have been many barriers to which that contributed. But the fact that there's a tremendous amount of power and control around corn flour. And so that's why we give it a particular focus in the piece.
It's astonishing that a single company, Polar, can control such large portions of the most, I mean, or at least one of the most vital food items in the country. And when quote unquote food riots happen and these shortages occur, no one can look towards that company to see what they're doing or to see where they politically align.
Exactly.
And in the piece, you even discuss how they're essentially them, along with a few other private companies, can really be traced back to the same sort of colonial elites that you discussed earlier.
Absolutely. You look at the names of the key families, in this case, the Mendoza Flores family that is behind Polar, and you look at the names, which we did, and it's all there, accessible in online archives, et cetera, of who the main petroleum concessions went to, who were the key actors in the agro-import complex and agro-export complex earlier on, and it's all there. Even though Polar portrays itself as having these humble origins, and that's a big part of its marketing campaign of being this sort of product of the people, but you look at the power of these families, and it's tremendous.
I want to read a sentence from your essay, and it's in the section on called Food Lines and Fault Lines. You say, quote, "First, it is important to look carefully at the food lines, their composition, their location, and what products are being sought. The people waiting in these lines have overwhelmingly been poor working class women. An attack on everyday life at the household level, as well as on the popular organization of the Bolivarian Revolution, in which women have played a key role. The lines have also largely formed outside supermarkets, where consumers wait to access certain specific items that have mostly gone missing from the shelves. These consist of the most consumed industrially processed products in the Venezuelan food basket, particularly pre-cooked corn flour." And then you go on to continue and describe how for several of the items, while they went missing from the shelves of supermarkets, they were still found at restaurants. Or some of the items, you say, for example, quote, "For while pre-cooked corn flour has gone missing, corn-based porridge has remained available. Milk powder disappeared from the shelves, but fresh dairy products like cheeses can still be found," and so on. So I wanted to know if you could sort of talk about this whole section, but really that paragraph seems key to me, that the composition, location, and products that are being sought from the food lines, that's sort of the missing link in a lot of the media narrative.
Absolutely. Thank you for flagging it, because as you say, it is so little discussed, because often in the media, there's just this picture presented of just nothing. You go into the supermarket and there's nothing. And right. I can verify, you know, I lived in Venezuela for 2 years and also visited many communities, spoke with many people. And when you go into the supermarkets, there's food there, but it's surreal because it's the selectivity of the missing products. And again, I think this doesn't fit neatly into the narratives of just everything collapsing and pure mismanagement, et cetera. Because yes, why are there certain products in the supermarkets, but not others? And why are some of the very products missing? So you cannot go to a supermarket and buy pre-cooked corn flour, but you can go into a shopping center and go into an arepera restaurant where they sell arepas and get a nice arepa. There's all these disconnects. And also, interestingly, the products of Polar, it has quite a global presence as well. And so you could find corn flour in many other parts of the world, the Polar's corn flour as well. So yeah, I think that's really key. And something else key in terms of sort of trying to dismantle these narratives a bit is that there was this equation in the mainstream narratives of, okay, it's these people waiting outside of line, outside of supermarkets and lines, they're getting fed up and now they're rioting. We saw that a lot in 2017. And I was there that whole time, where the supposedly the street protests were a direct extension of the food lines because hungry people were rioting. And we also try to address that in the essay by pointing out that for the most part, these are two very distinct groups in terms of class and racial composition, background, in terms of the interests, in terms of a lot of different things. The street protesters and those who are actually waiting in line are distinct groups. And that's another thing that gets that's often glossed over in the narratives.
Before we get into sort of the mechanisms of the actual protest and riots themselves, I also want you to mention or I guess explain a little bit about the black market that has been created due to these intentional food shortages. Because of the food shortages, which are intentional by companies like Polar, there's been the creation of a black market, which I don't know if you've seen it, but journalist Abby Martin has a documentary in which she actually tries to expose this black market.
Yes.
And the other thing are the stockpiles, which have been discovered mm-hmm. all across the country. And as you mentioned, the article, the stockpiles, which people have tried to smuggle to other countries from Venezuela mm-hmm. of food. So can you talk a little bit about the creation of the black market and the stockpiles?
Yeah. Thank you for bringing this up because I forgot to mention it. You have things going on multiple levels. One on kind of the individual, well, sort of the individual level, though it's also connected to various networks, is this phenomenon of bachaquismo. People are called bachaqueros, which is a type of ant that can carry a lot of weight on its back. And these are the people who are basically hawking these very products missing from the supermarket shelves on the street for many times the price in this sort of illicit parallel economy. So that's another sign of evidence that these products are indeed there and are somehow getting diverted, the fact that they're being sold all over the streets. And this is facilitated by the fact that Venezuela has a variety of different exchange rates. This is a topic of debate among economists for sure, and what needs to be done and how to fix this. But having these different exchange rates means that it helps to fuel this illicit economy. So that's one thing on the streets of Caracas. But then on top of that, there have been numerous reports, media reports, mainly domestic media in Venezuela. Hardly any of it gets into the international press, but numerous reports with photos of huge stockpiles of these very same products being found in Venezuela, both in warehouses as well as on trucks that are bringing it across the border into Colombia, where then there's all that what the media does get is that Venezuelans are going across the border into Colombia to access food, but often they're accessing these very same products. And you would think that would make a fascinating media story, but for some reason that has not made it into the media. But yes, there's this phenomenon of these products getting diverted and fueling an illicit parallel economy as well as going across the border into Colombia mm-hmm. and elsewhere.
Now, I remember in 2017, there was a photo that went viral of food stockpiled in a warehouse. And the caption on the tweet, it went viral on Twitter, said, "This is Nicolas Maduro withholding food from his population so they starve." Of course, within a matter of minutes, tons and tons of people had replied to the tweet and quote tweeted and said, actually, this is a stockpile from the opposition and this is something they do regularly. But the narrative had already been set. And then this picture, you know, and this tweet was screenshotted and reproduced hundreds, if not thousands of times. And then, of course, as you describe in your essay, there has been a sort of intentional act to target or dismantle or damage actual, you know, states' food supplies, as well as other methods of civic infrastructure, right, or domestic infrastructure, by the food protests that are sort of supported by the opposition party. So can you sort of explain this mechanism of protest and the internal workings of it?
Absolutely. And first, just starting with the depiction of Maduro, and before Maduro is Chavez, you know, trying to withhold food from the people. What the response of the government actually was, starting in 2016, was this unrolling of a massive effort called CLAPS, which are local provisioning and supply committees focused on getting food, the food missing from supermarket shelves, to the people that needed it. And we can talk about CLAPS later if we want, but just to say, those are the kind of government efforts happening on the magnitude of their 30,000 plus of these committees now in Venezuela. It's a massive effort of partnership between the government and communities that's now reaching about 3/4 of the population. It's reaching the vast majority of people, and it's indeed proven to be a lifeline. So that's the kind of response coming from the government, which either is not covered or is totally warped in the way that it's covered. But on top of that, yes, exactly. In these so-called food riots, these street protests that were especially prevalent in 2017, again, these are supposed, in the media, these are depicted as hungry masses taking to the streets, both in response to hunger and an authoritarian regime. And what's not discussed for the most part are the targets of these protests in 2017, which included the National Institute of Nutrition. One of its headquarters was set on fire. A laboratory that was making agroecological inputs, that was vandalized. And quite tellingly, one of the warehouses that was holding food, either for CLAPS or one of the other government-supported feeding programs, tons of food were burned and destroyed. And you would think if these were hungry people fighting for justice, maybe they would have stolen the food and redistributed it. But it's awfully odd that hungry masses would burn tons of food. So mm-hmm. Yes, that's another important dimension.
Exactly. Yeah, the whole narrative is bizarre. I mean, if they want to paint Maduro as sort of an unpopular elected official who's barely hanging on to a people besieged with unrest, why would he order the burning of food? I mean, sort of no part of it even really makes sense when you really just take a second to digest what you're being told. And before we get to sort of your section on resistance and what the response has been, sort of the grassroots efforts, I want mm-hmm. to quickly, I guess, before, because I know we've went over on time already, but it's been a great conversation, speak about the race and class composition of these protests specifically. I know that there were incidents of violence, which was racialized violence, of course. And I think that's an important factor in this as well, to really paint the picture of this for the listeners.
Absolutely. That was an incredibly disturbing thing that, happened right when I was there, especially in 2017, that unfortunately, these protesters were not just destroying property and burning food. They were also targeting people. And quite a number of people were the targets of these mobs. And basically across the board, these were people who fit the characteristics typical of Bolivarian Revolution supporters, which is the poor, Afro-Indigenous, working class majority of the population. And one of the most tragic moments, which was caught on film, was when a young supermarket worker, and that's an interesting connection too, that he was a supermarket worker, was set ablaze by one of these so-called street protesters. And this was done in broad daylight in front of everyone, captured on film. Nobody did anything, and he died. And his life meant nothing to those people, apparently. And this was replicated many times over, several of which were caught on film. And a number of scholars and reporters have looked at this and the fact that this is nothing new. Racial slurs have been used to characterize both the leadership and the base of the Bolivarian Revolution. These divides on race and class have run very strong in Venezuelan society. And also getting to the race and class composition of the street protesters, this is largely obscured in the media, but there was one important exception, and we do flag this, and there's a link to it in the essay, which was actually a piece that came out in Bloomberg about the social life of the street protesters. And I do want to say it's not fair to paint them as entirely homogenous. They're not. But this particular group of street protesters that was the focus of this Bloomberg article, they openly said, you know, you protest by day, but that doesn't mean that you start living by night. And all of these elaborate parties and events on rooftop shisha bars, all of this was going on at the same time that the street protests were happening by the protesters who were kind of living these dual lives, and in many ways carrying on with the lives that they had been living while at the same time disrupting people's ability to get to work, to get to school, to access food. And one of the most vulnerable groups in all this were the service workers, the poorer working class people who actually work for these wealthier people who had to cross the lines in these dangerous street protests, knowing that they could very well be a target, very dangerous conditions. And this is those were some of the dynamics that are largely obscured in the media, but that point to quite a bit more of a story going on.
The sort of optic of going and protesting by day and painting yourself as the poor, oppressed worker who just wants bread and rice and flour, and then at night going to like an upscale rooftop bar. You know what I mean? It's
And I couldn't believe. Exactly. I actually couldn't believe, you know, occasionally, if you really follow the media, occasionally there will be these little grains that share a different side of the story. And so I really appreciated that article came out because, of course, this is something well known. You could ask any average Venezuelan about this and they know it. But I think it gives it a certain... you know, more credibility among some people that it appeared in Bloomberg.
Right. Now, I guess the final part of this interview, and really what may be the most important part of the interview, given sort of, as I stated earlier, the current imperialist aggression against Venezuela and the Bolivarian Revolution at large, is the resistance and the response to these assaults on food and food sovereignty and the great strides in eradicating hunger that, as you mentioned earlier, Venezuela had taken. As you start this section of the essay, you say, quote, as one Venezuelan food sovereignty activist commented on the present situation, in war, one must eat. Responses to the challenges have taken many forms, and while a full discussion is beyond the scope of this particular article, we will give a broad overview. First, if everyday life is the main battleground on which present problems are playing out, it is also the front line of resistance. When the shortages began, among the first lines of defense to be activated was a kind of parallel solidarity economy involving the sharing and bartering of food and other essentials among neighbors, as well as a reactivation of survival techniques from the past. So can you kind of elaborate more on that and discuss what was the initial response of the people to these food problems?
Sure. I would be glad to. And this is a part I can speak to quite easily because I was directly witnessing this myself. For the most part of the 2 years that I was living in Venezuela, I was living in the working class community of El Valle in Caracas. And so the family I was living with and our neighbors, everyone was going through this together where all of a sudden it was very hard to access basic foods, especially before the response of the CLAPS, those committees that I mentioned, kicked in. And so what did people do? They shared what they had. They called any family and friends in the countryside to create new ways of getting fresh foods into the city, distributing them. They would purchase in bulk and distribute among neighbors. Many more people started growing what they could on windowsills, on backyard patios, saving seeds, exchanging seeds, and also just sharing tips. Because again, it's really important to emphasize that food remained available the whole time. It was just different types of foods. So people came to rely more on cassava, or what they call yuca, on sweet potatoes, on plantains, on fresh sugar cane instead of refined sugar, on coconut and other products. But you know, because Venezuela has been so reliant on this industrial food complex, some people needed to share tips with each other of, okay, what do we do with this fresh food? How do we cook it? So there was a lot of that kind of exchanging happening. And also, because people really need their arepas, they found ways, even though there was no fresh pre-cooked corn flour, people started buying directly from farmers and from open air markets, fresh corn, which is the traditional way of making arepas. And you clean the kernels and boil them, and then you grind them. So many people actually had hand grinders that had belonged to their grandparents, and they brought them out, dusted them off, and communities, neighbors shared their hand grinders with each other, and there would be little grinding parties and things. So all of this unfolded, and it spoke to all these survival mechanisms that had been there all along. Because again, these are the same communities that the supermarkets had never been meant for them to begin with. And these are the same communities that had already survived through the Caracaso and other hard times. So in many ways, what they're going through now is nothing so new, and are the types of challenges that they've already lived through in their ancestors have already lived through. So yes, all of these survival techniques were being reactivated and shared.
And it's wonderful to hear this because, I mean, I don't want to keep on comparing Venezuela to Cuba because there's endless parallels that can be made, but they are still separate, states, right? But nonetheless, it again reminds me of the special period as it relates to food. And you see the rise in foods that could be produced widely on a Caribbean island. Things like eggs, and then tropical fruits and vegetables, as you mentioned, yuca, plantains, and sort of these indigenous foods that were in abundance. And you have a rebirth, or even not even a rebirth, I guess, like a reinvigoration of food popularity, right? And the tactics of survival. Not even as a sort of ashamed notion, but as something of pride and to be proud of. In the case of Cuba, I don't know that it's like that for Venezuela, but I know in the case of Cuba, there was a sort of pride in the struggle and in the survival tactics that were easily enacted.
Yes, and I think you're definitely not the only one for whom this reminds you of Cuba. And especially, I haven't really spoken to some of the same survival techniques that were being rolled out in the countryside, but people are similarly having a hard time accessing seeds and agrochemicals because all of that had also been through the import complex. And so by necessity, people are returning to agroecological and traditional growing techniques. And there are many parallels to Cuba's special period in that. In a way, it just hasn't been as organized and maybe as recognized by the government and supported the way it could be. And so that's what that's part of the struggle there among food sovereignty activists to say, hey, you know, well, first of all, things are very, very hard. But in the midst of all this hard time, there's actually some really important efforts towards deeper transformation happening. Mm-hmm. And how can we, you know, really foster this and use this to actually build towards the food sovereignty that we were working towards all along? And someone made the point, who's both an activist and part of the government, he made the point, you know, we've been working towards food sovereignty all these years, but it was more just a political priority because we had all this, all these resources, we still had our food imports and everything. Now it's become a material necessity, and we know what we have to do, and we have been working towards this. So it's about really stepping up our efforts. So I think it's important to emphasize because it is, things are really, really, really hard right now. And there's the whole side that I'm sure other speakers have covered on the sanctions, the economic blockade, and what's that's doing to the people. But just to say that within all of that, there's tremendous resistance, and some of it actually does have some really important transformative potential.
I think for people who've never lived in or experienced for an extended amount of time cultures and sort of societies, communities that are working towards food sovereignty, or where that's at least a mainstay conversation even, it can feel very foreign, the politics of food, especially in the U.S. where we're very far removed from the process of food. Versus in October, when I was in Cuba, I spoke with farmers who were discussing the politics of their autonomy, in a sense that because they were so successful in sort of transforming from commercial to more domestic agricultural practices, that they now are sort of seen as leaders of their community in Matanzas in a bit. And these dynamics are not very well understood in the West. But the point is that the politics of food are so important because these people really do become community leaders, in a sense. So not to keep you for any longer, I think we've covered all the bases very, very well, obviously quickly and succinctly. So I would recommend everybody listening, read the full essay, and then find her email if you have any questions, or, you know, tweet at me and I can relay questions to Christina as well if finding an email is too difficult. But anything else you'd like to add to that, Christina?
I guess I would just add that the struggle very much continues in Venezuela, and something that we were clear about in our work, you know, this is the basis of my PhD work, and I've, you know, tried to take it seriously as a scholar, but just to say that researching this doesn't mean that we cannot stand together with the grassroots movements on the ground who are really, you know, in against so many odds, are doing incredible work at the same time that they're being invisibilized and basically erased, not only in the mainstream media, which we might expect, but also in many progressive and leftist circles as well. So I really encourage everyone to look at what's happening on the ground, not just make it about single leaders, but recognize that this is a process that's being led by millions of people, and they all have voices and they all have perspectives, and it's not black and white, and there are many shades of gray. And so I guess just to try to follow that more closely, and for those who are inclined to do so, to really stand with these movements, especially right now in the face of many attacks.
Good day, everyone. This is Jeanette Charles, International Solidarity Liaison with Venezuela Analysis. I want to remind today's listeners that Venezuela Analysis has teamed up with Grounding on this very historic occasion for a two-part series specially dedicated to Venezuela and the most recent U.S.-backed coup. On today's program, we have on the line Akinyele Umoja, who's traveled to Venezuela specifically to do work around Afro-Venezuelan movements and establish ties across the African diaspora with the purpose of Black liberation. Akinyele, can you please introduce yourself for today's listeners?
How are you doing, listeners? I'm a professor at Georgia State University in African-American Studies. I'm also an author. Most notable book I wrote came out in 2013 called We Will Shoot Back, Armed Resistance in the Mississippi Freedom Movement. Also founder of New African People's Organization.
Awesome. That is incredible work. Can you please let us know a little bit before we dive in about the ways in which your movement and organizational work has been tied to Venezuela and the Bolivarian process?
Well, as I mentioned, I'm a member of Malcolm X Grassroots Movement, and we supported the Bolivarian Revolution for decades. And most importantly, the Bolivarian Revolution actually, we initially tied, I can't say initially, but after Hurricane Katrina and the disaster there, when Hugo Chavez and the Bolivarian government reached out and offered support to the survivors in New Orleans and the Gulf Coast. We were very impressed with that offer of solidarity, even though the United States would not accept it. And in some of the work we had to try to organize people in the Gulf Coast and through particularly groups like the People's Hurricane Relief Fund, we organized a tribunal, and we had representation from Venezuela, in particular Jesus Chucho Garcias, who's an Afro-descendant organizer in Venezuela, an intellectual as well as a diplomat for the Bolivarian Revolution, and we established close ties with him. We learned more about the Afro-descendant movement, and particularly we had a bond together because the Afro-descendant movement kind of reached another level in Venezuela and throughout South and Central America with the Durban Conference Against Racism, World Conference Against Racism in 2001, and the motion towards that conference elevated the movement in Venezuela and in other places.
Akinyele, can you talk to us a little bit more about how the Malcolm X grassroots movement and the U.S. Black South has engaged with Venezuela and what that political relationship has been over the years?
Since one of our positions and one of our principles of unity in our organization is reparations, we kind of bonded with Chucho Garcia and people in the National Network of Venezuelan Organizations and other Afro-descendant movements we began to bond with. And then as we began to do work, particularly in Jackson, Mississippi, organizing a people's assembly and a people's platform and running first our former our late member, Chokwe Lumumba, who's now our ancestor, when he ran for city council, the Bolivarian Revolution actually did an offer of solidarity to his ward by providing lights, light bulbs to people in his community free of charge. Just the Bolivarian Revolution offered to anyone who needed these energy efficient light bulbs to people in that community. That was one form of solidarity. And then they sent a delegation when 2013, when Chokwe was elected mayor of Jackson, Mississippi. And so, of course, Chokwe died the following year, but it was that bond of solidarity. I remember at that time traveling with the delegation and going through parts of Jackson, Mississippi. So we took them, for instance, to the home of Medgar Evers, where Medgar Evers was assassinated. We also took them to where in 1971, where the FBI raided the residents of the Republic of New Africa. And they had great appreciation for that history. And again, they reached out in terms of having solidarity exchanges of students, things of that nature. So, but we've had that relationship or built a relationship, people to people relationship with people from Venezuela. Chokwe actually visited there in, I believe it was in 2010, to one of the encuentros or encounters, gatherings of African descendants that was organized down there also. So we began to kind of build a relationship with them.
Something that I want to share with our listeners is that you and I actually met at the first International Reparations Summit that was hosted in Venezuela last year. And we'll talk a little bit more about reparations and their significance for the Bolivarian process and the African diaspora and African continent at large. But I wanted you to talk a little bit about what you have observed in Venezuela in your last several visits. I know the Reparations Summit was not your first visit, nor was it your last. So can you tell us a little bit more about the time you've spent in Venezuela, what you've seen and what you've learned?
I was invited last year twice. Number one, I came to Venezuela when President Maduro in March signed the United Nations International Decade of People of African Descent, which of course begins in 2015. And we had Afro descendants from around the Americas who attended that conference, as well as people from the African continent itself and from the Caribbean who were in attendance there. Danny Glover, of course, was there and was present. And he, of course, is the UN ambassador for the decade, International Decade of People of African Descent. There, and that being my first time, I was impressed as we were taken to different parts of the country, particularly in the state of Miranda, which has a high percentage of people of African descent. We are, even before doing that, we met the mayor of Caracas, who was a Black woman. But in visiting the state of Miranda, we not only experienced the culture of the people, we not only experienced meeting leaders, particularly African descended leaders of not only the state, but of municipalities. But we also one of the two highlights of the visit was visiting the socialist city of Hugo Chavez, which is this housing development that houses thousands, tens of thousands of people, and where they had substandard housing before. Now they have apartments, and in their apartments that, you know, houses again tens of thousands of people, but it has schools there, has schools. And as many of you know who traveled to underdeveloped countries, that many times children in those countries have to pay to go to school. But this is a free schools for free education, public education for children there, and as well as health care and employment for people in that community. Nearby that community and miles away, we visited this chocolate factory. And in this particular community, historically, Black people, going back to slavery, were the ones who cultivated the plant, the cacao plant that makes chocolate, the chocolate is made from. And then now, given this socialist cooperative business has been developed, where Black people not only have been cultivating the plant, but they also make products from that, whether it's candy bars, whether it's chocolates, whether it's hot chocolate that they are producing there. And they not only work the factory, but they manage and run the factory. So those were some of the developments. But one of the most exciting things from that trip in March is President Maduro announced that he would host an international conference on reparations. And we were all excited about that. And when I say we, people from around the world, delegations from around the world, were excited, but as well as the Venezuelans, Afro-Venezuelans themselves, because this is something they had been pushing for a while. And so this conference was called in May of 2018. And there were a couple of things going on during the time of that conference. Number one, Afro-Venezuelan youth were meeting and convening during the same time. And we got to visit and interact with youth who were learning their culture, learning their history, learning the politics of the country. But they also were tying that and to the historic tradition of Black resistance in that country, particularly symbolized by what is called the Cimarron. I prefer the term Quilombo myself, but the Cimarron tradition, which is what some people call the Maroon tradition. So those Africans who escaped and went to the woods, the hills, the mountains, the swamps, and began to resist and form communities from there. And I'll come back to that in a second.
Awesome. As well, yes.
As well as another thing is you had this conference that took place with representation from Grenada, representation from Barbados and Trinidad, representation from many of the South American countries, particularly Bolivia and Uruguay and Argentina. You had representation there. You had people there from the African continent, from places like Gambia, places like Comoros Islands, places like Namibia, places like South Africa and Algeria, all meeting around this question of reparations. Key in both meetings was the presence of Muriel Fanon, who is the daughter of the great Frantz Fanon. And she, who was an international human rights scholar, helped guide us through this process of what reparations looks like. And then how can we move on an international stage? I also should mention that the head of state of St. Vincent and Grenadines, Ralph Concalves, also came and addressed our conference. And he and President Maduro addressed our conference. And we came out with several resolutions to forward the reparations movement in the Western Hemisphere. And particularly at that time, President Maduro became the first Latin American head of state to declare his solidarity with the struggle for reparations, not just as not just a passive solidarity, but Venezuela would provide space and material support for this movement for reparations, along with the CARICOM countries. And so he particularly supported the initiative of the CARICOM countries in their demand for reparations from the British Empire. But they also were going to support or pledge their support for the reparations of African descendants on the African continent, as well as here in the Americas. And so it was a powerful occasion. So those were the two times. And then this year in 2019, I had the opportunity to visit Venezuela during the inauguration of President Maduro. And that was a powerful occasion. Again, you had 94 different states were represented at the inauguration of President Maduro, again, showing that he had international support and support for his election. And as much as many of your audience would know, that the United States opposed his inauguration, opposed the elections that took place in May of 2018. But we can't say the majority of the world came out to support it. And not only that, there was representation from the United Nations, but most importantly, the Venezuelan people, hundreds of thousands of them were in the street in support of President Maduro's election. There was also, I mentioned the representation from states, but there was representation there from people's movements, from Europe, from Canada, from Africa, from, again, throughout the Americas, people there. And again, particularly African descendants from all those places were there in support of the revolution. So I've had the opportunity to visit on those three occasions, and it's actually kind of prepared me for this period right now, because I think I had the information that I could go and begin to talk to people in the communities I work in, and to try to challenge a lot of the propaganda we hear on CNN and on MSNBC and on Fox, propaganda that really doesn't talk about the impact that of sanctions of the United States, Canada, and European countries have had on the Venezuelan economy. So they make it seem that socialism, in fact, Trump actually said that in his State of the Union, that socialism was the problem, right? That it created this chaos that Venezuela is in. Not looking at, again, or not talking about the economic war they've actually waged on the Venezuelan people and on the Bolivarian Revolution. Besides speaking people and challenging this propaganda, particularly around what's happened in terms of destabilizing Venezuela, we could also talk to them about what popular support, again, exists for the Venezuelan revolution in spite of the economic war that's been waged on the Venezuelan people. They still, which is why I think that elements of the right wing didn't participate in these elections that they initially agreed to, and why Trump and Pence did not want them to participate, because they know that still there's a still, in spite of this economic war, there's still a large amount of economic support, excuse me, not economic, but popular support of the Venezuelan people for the Bolivarian Revolution and for the Maduro government.
Yeah. And, you know, Akinyele, you've walked us through such an incredible timeline in the last three occasions that you've been able to visit Venezuela, from May of 2018 to January of this year. And I just want to remind our listeners that, you know, a lot of the Venezuelan, or I want to remind our listeners that, you know, Venezuela's Bolivarian process in many ways encapsulates a reparations model, which is exactly what you're talking about, you know, free and universal healthcare, free public education. In December of 2018, you know, Venezuela had hit the 2.5 million home mark. You know, they have built 2.5 million homes, public housing across the country in approximately 6 years, essentially turning Venezuela into the world's greatest housing developer for working class and poor families. And this is something that you directly have seen on the ground, and that anyone who visits Venezuela cannot deny is in existence. I want you to talk to us a little bit about what your thoughts are in terms of what folks can and should be doing in solidarity with Venezuela, and especially thinking about it from a Black internationalist perspective.
Well, the first thing I think we need to do is to give people information. That's number one, because again, there's so much propaganda in the commercial media in the United States, and people don't think, you know, that the news they get represents a particular economic interest and political interest. But we have to give people alternative sources of information, and so the institution you represent, Venezuela Analysis, we have to make sure that that information is spread. Sources like Telesur, in English for those of us who read English, and Spanish for those who read Spanish, which is the Venezuelan news service, but also even just listening to Democracy Now, where you might hear a more balanced perspective, definitely more balanced than you're going to hear in the commercial media, to give people information. We got to make sure that information is circulated and do everything we can to go, you know, talk to people in the barber shops, the beauty shops, in churches, in faith communities, in schools, and make sure that people have that information. But that's key, because I think, number one, it's a propaganda war being waged. Number two, I think we should write our people in Congress, write them, tweet them, email them, and demand that there's no war on the Venezuelan people, that war, no military intervention is done in our names. People need to, again, write their congressmen, write their senators, and demand that sanctions against Venezuela be ended. And we call for no military intervention, but there's already an economic war going on against the Venezuelan people. And so we call upon the end of the war. We call for the end of military intervention, but we also must do the political education in our communities to begin to arm people with information.
And I want to return to this other, to the issue of reparations, as you've mentioned already. You know, so many different nations in contemporary history have demanded reparations. As you mentioned, you know, the countries in CARICOM, the Caribbean community, peoples across the African continent, folks in the diaspora here in the United States. What I want you to talk to us a little bit about the significance of calling for reparations and also the historical backlash that has been waged against countries that have demanded reparations. You know, I want to highlight that, you know, as we speak, not only are Venezuelans defending their sovereignty and self-determination, but also the Haitian people have in the last 2 weeks been mobilizing massively to denounce corruption, UN occupation, US-backed illegitimate governance, and demanding their right to democracy and sovereignty as well. And that's getting very little media attention internationally. And these two things are happening simultaneously. And so, you know, if we think back about to Lavalas and the Jean-Bertrand Aristide government of 2004, one of the last things that his administration demanded was reparations. So I'm wondering, Akinyele, if you can talk to us a little bit about the connections between Haiti and Venezuela, or just your thoughts on what's happening currently across the Caribbean in regard to reparations, the right for sovereignty and self-determination, and how this might impact our movements, our Black-led organizing movements in the United States and across the diaspora.
Well, Haiti and Venezuela are historically linked. You know, as much of your audience may know, well, let me just say this, because maybe they don't know because we've been so miseducated. And I say we, is the Haitian Revolution was one of the most important historic events of the 18th and 19th century. You know, Haitian Revolution, actually, Haiti gets its independence from France in 1804. The Revolutionary War actually begins in 1791, even though there's resistance prior to that. But that revolution became a beacon for people around the globe, actually, became a beacon for people throughout the African diaspora wanting to free themselves from enslavement, became a beacon for even Greek patriots trying to free themselves from the Ottoman Empire. And they were actually sent solidarity and support from Haiti. But in particular, in terms of Venezuela, they were able to provide troops. They were able to provide arms. They were able to provide materials aid to Simon Bolivar as he began to attack the Spanish Empire in South America, establishing Venezuela and providing independence to other nations in South America. It's linked to the Bolivarian Revolution because that's one of the things that Hugo Chavez recognized and acknowledged, is the historic role of Haiti in bringing about the independence of Venezuela. Now, as we talk about the Venezuelan process and Bolivarian process, there was a similar, I would say, process that occurred in Haiti after the Papa and Baby Doc regimes were overthrown by the Haitian people. They were really run out of Haiti because of the mass action and civil disobedience of the Haitian people. Then you had the election in 1990 of Jean-Bertrand Aristide. And then, of course, you know that there was a military coup, and we think about the current coup, but it follows a similar model. It's not only the coup that occurred in 1991, but there was a coup in 2004 that is more similar to what they're trying to do in Venezuela today in terms of having economic destabilization, trying to create a crisis, and then coming in with paramilitary squads, things of that nature, and claiming they're, you know, the U.S. is the cavalry coming in to save the day. But one of the reasons that the United States, France, and Canada were so opposed to Jean-Bertrand Aristide in Haiti was of him demanding that France pay $21 billion in to in restitution, really, from France that forced Haiti to pay equivalent of that sum in gold francs after Haiti won its independence from France. Because, when Haiti wins its independence from France in 1804, Haiti, before it was a colony of Saint-Domingue, was the most valuable colony in the Western Hemisphere. And that wealth was built off the backs of the blood and the lives of African people who lived with short life expectancies in that particular colony at that time. And so it's actually France that owes reparations to, you know, the descendants of those African people, the people who survived. But instead, they demanded, since they had this great loss. Of course, we know that the Louisiana Purchase occurred because of, you know, France's loss of wealth in this war against Haiti, war against the Haitian people. So John Petrone Aristide demanded restitution from France because of that. And that's one of the reasons, fearing that the Western powers ganged up and wanted to see him deposed. Not only that, but what he was trying to do in his own country in terms of creating social programs, creating health care for people, advancing people's literacy level, things that, and trying to create an economy that Haitians would control their own affairs, not be subject to the West anymore. That he began that process. And so so when we look at Venezuela demanding reparations, again, that same fear from the Western powers and the same Western powers gang up. And they, again, they're concerned not just about this demand for reparations and the model and what it represents. And Venezuela, in some ways, in terms of what it's done in terms of housing, as you mentioned before, what it's done in terms of empowering people with forming cooperatives, economic cooperatives like the one I mentioned before, is a form of reparations. But the most important thing is done is investing in the education and embracing the legacy and history and empowering the identity of Afro descendants in Venezuela. So I think that's something that is feared by the West at this time. But they're not only doing that, but it's just this whole new model of how wealth will be distributed the Venezuelan, the Bolivarian Revolution has, is opposed to the oil wealth being used to benefit just a small minority, and Western imperialism has redirected the wealth. And so that's how the housing that you talked about is being built. That's how healthcare is being distributed to people, so people can have healthcare and education throughout the country. One of the community in Caracas, I visited this community where poor people lived up a mountain, you know, up the different levels of the mountain. And there was no roads to get them from the bottom of the mountain to the top of the mountain. And there, so if you were a person who had a disability, it was very difficult for you to go down the mountain and to bring produce in particular up the mountain after you went grocery shopping. And once Chavez became aware of that, then they built like a ski lift to take people from the bottom of the mountain up to the top of the mountain. And I got to see that development and see the plaque that's there for thanking, you know, President Chavez for building that. And it was actually a man who was disabled who brought that to his attention. They have a picture of that man. So again, that's a kind of clear thing of what the revolution meant to people. In a way, that's a form of reparations, because again, that wealth wasn't going to the, you know, people who labored and helped build the country, but went to the more privileged elements of society. And it affects because as Venezuela, like many other countries around the world, people of African descent and indigenous folks are generally at the bottom. Right. And, you know, it's been built on our backs. Our ancestors were the ones whose labor or land was expropriated. And so it takes a government that has that type of intentionality to bring us out of that situation and give us the space to fight for it ourselves. Because I don't want people to go away from thinking that the Afro-Venezuelan movement, as well as the indigenous movement for that matter in Venezuela, aren't asserting themselves. And they're not just looking for handouts. They're struggling to find their place in the country, and they're struggling to be respected as human beings in the country.
That's an important point. And, you know, speaking of handouts, I think I would really like for you to talk to us about this question of the U.S. government sending, quote unquote, humanitarian aid to Venezuela. Talk to us a little bit about that, Akinyele. What does that actually mean? What's going on there?
Well, what's going on is you rob the people, like those of your listeners who just buy gas from Citgo, the profits from Citgo, which is the Venezuelan, company. It's the company of the government, right? Their profits are not allowed because of these sanctions to go to Venezuelan people. So they create a crisis, and then they utilize by supporting this puppet president Guaido, they give him aid to empower him as a means, as a weapon. So this type of aid is used as a weapon to they destabilize you on one level, and then they support their puppet on the other level. And this is just a means, since Guaido doesn't have popular support. You know, I saw a study saying that only 1 out of 5 of the Venezuelan people even knew who the hell he was at the time he declared himself president. Right. But the key thing about him is it's clear that he's the puppet of Donald Trump. Right. And so they also made an appeal to get support from military officers. That hasn't happened. The military command in the country has stayed loyal to Maduro. So they now use this weapon to, through Colombia, who's also a client state of the United States and Donald Trump. They try to put this aid again, wealth that's been denied the Venezuelan people. Again, when we talk about the sanctions, we are also including wealth that actually belongs to Venezuela. Particularly if we look at the amount of gold. I forgot, you probably know, Jeanette, the amount of gold that
it's 1.3 billion dollars, the equivalent of $1.3 billion in gold.
Mm-hmm. So their gold is being held by the British. And again, not allowed to use the people. And then they make it seem as if socialism is the reason there's economic crisis. They've created a crisis, but then withhold the wealth. But then at the same time, they offer it to their puppet to utilize to, again, try to get some sort of support for him. And so it's a clear means of economic war is being used. This offering of humanitarian aid, and I say humanitarian in quotes, is just another form of warfare being used against the people of Venezuela, and another assault on the sovereignty of the Venezuelan people.
Yeah, and it's really interesting because, you know, organizations like the Red Cross, the United Nations, and even Oxfam have declined to participate in this U.S. humanitarian aid mission. You know, just recently, the U.S. sent 3 additional aircraft carriers, military aircraft carriers, to the Venezuelan-Colombian border, and they've landed in Cúcuta, which is a notorious site in Colombia for being kind of the bastion of economic destabilization and paramilitary violence against Venezuela. And they only have about the equivalent of $20 million of U.S. humanitarian aid, which I think is 10 days worth of food and supplies for about 8,000 people. And I just want to emphasize that, you know, Venezuela has a population of 32 million people, and the vast majority are not necessarily all living along the border of Venezuela and Colombia. So it's an interesting, you know, set of circumstances that I think really speak to your earlier points, Akinyele, about, you know, propaganda and really what this is as a mission that's disguised, a military mission that's disguised as humanitarian aid. So with all of that said, you know, I want to ask, what are some of your final comments and reflections about the current moment of this U.S.-backed coup against Venezuela? And what, if anything else, should we be keeping our eyes open on?
Well, again, I think that war is being waged on the Venezuelan people in our name. So we have the responsibility to act. Even if you don't support the Bolivarian Revolution, you have a responsibility to not see number 45, as he's oftentimes called in our community, Donald Trump, create a war. I mean, those of us who see what he did in trying to get the wall and how federal employees miss paychecks because he wanted this wall being built. And so he was willing to create the stabilization in people's lives. So we could multiply that by 1,000, by 10,000 in terms of the impact it's had, maybe 1,000,000 even. We can multiply that in terms of what impact that's had, that these sanctions have had on the Venezuelan people. And the type of, we know just from what he was willing to do to people, some who even voted for him, in terms of disrupting their lives. We know the callousness he deals with Venezuelans with. So it's important for us to challenge them on this, to resist, to make sure that Venezuelans have a government that they elected. You know, 68% of the people in their elections came out and voted for Nicolas Maduro. And again, if you look, and just look at the images of Venezuelans in the street in support of their government, you see that that's the government of the people. And so even if you don't support the revolution, if you support democracy, you have to be opposed to this coup in Venezuela. So again, call your congressman, oppose any military intervention, and also oppose these sanctions and share this information with other people, because it's going to be through that people-to-people contact, even here, that we're able to build a movement of solidarity to stop this coup from happening.
Thank you so much, Akinyele. I want to remind our listeners that we are talking with Akinyele Umoja of the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement, who has traveled on repeated occasions to Venezuela, most recently in January, to accompany the inauguration of Nicolas Maduro, who, as you heard from Akinyele, is the democratically elected president. Thank you so much for participating in today's program. I want to also remind folks that if you'd like to get involved with the End U.S. and Canada Sanctions Campaign, you can check us out at Facebook on End Venezuela Sanctions. You can also go to the Alliance for Global Justice website and go to the U.S. End Canada and Sanctions campaign. You can also email endvenezuelasanctions@gmail.com. And as always, as Akinyele has recommended, please continue to watch the coverage at Venezuela Analysis. You can check us out at venezuelanalysis.com on Facebook and Twitter. And you can email us at editor@venezuelanalysis.com. Thank you again so much, Akinyele. And thank you to Devin at Groundings for this incredible collaboration series.